This is VOA News, reporting by remote. I'm David Byrd. President-elect Joe Biden spent the Thanksgiving holiday in the small seaside town of Rehoboth, Delaware, where he and his wife, Jill, have a vacation home. The president-elect, appearing with his wife in a video message posted to his Twitter account on Thanksgiving, said his family typically holds a large gathering on the island of Nantucket off Massachusetts, but would remain in Delaware this year. Biden said that Americans were making a shared sacrifice for the whole country and a statement of common purpose by staying at home with their immediate families. The president-elect acknowledged that this Thanksgiving was not like many had hoped, but called staying home for the holiday a gift to our fellow Americans and promised better days are coming. President Donald Trump answered reporters' questions for the first time since the election and held on to unproven and baseless theories that there was massive fraud and that's why he lost. We get more from AP's Jennifer King.
President Trump spoke to reporters at the White House after a Thanksgiving conversation with U.S. military members overseas.
How is Kuwait doing?
Trump renewed claims that fraud and crooked local officials in battleground states led to his election defeat.
It's going to be a very hard thing to concede, because we know there was massive fraud.
He says he's going to Georgia on December 5th for a rally to boost two Republican candidates facing runoff elections that will determine control of the Senate.
Maybe I'll go twice. It's very important that we win those races.
Trump told reporters he will leave the White House if the Electoral College votes in Joe Biden by the December deadline.
Certainly I will, and you know that. But I think that there will be a lot of things happening between now and the 20th.
Trump wouldn't say what his plans were for the inauguration. Jennifer King, Washington.
You can find more on these stories and the rest of the day's news at voanews.com. You can also follow us on the VOA mobile app. This is VOA News. The body of World Cup football winner Diego Maradona was driven in a procession from the presidential palace, where he had been lying in state Thursday, to Bella Vista Cemetery for the soccer legend's funeral. Mourners who had been waiting in line to pay their respects at the Casa Rosada clashed with police in nearby streets. Officers used water cannon to disperse some of those who crammed the city streets to say goodbye to their hero. Meanwhile, in Naples, fans streamed to the Napoli Stadium to say their goodbyes to the Argentine star, who died Wednesday of a heart attack at age 60. As England moves toward the lockdown finish line in early December, many will continue to face tight restrictions in the weeks to follow. AP's Karen Chamas has more.
The government announced details of three-level regional measures that will take effect on December the 2nd. UK Health Secretary Matt Hancock urged English citizens to stick to the rules.
To keep people safe and to keep the gains that are being made, more areas than before will be in the top two tiers. This is necessary to protect our NHS and keep the virus under control.
More than half of England's 56 million people, including London's 8.6 million residents, are in the middle level, where most shops, restaurants and leisure businesses can open with some restrictions. Another 23 million people in a huge chunk of central and northern England will be placed in the top tier. Under these, the toughest rules, pubs and restaurants can only serve takeout and delivery, and leisure venues such as cinemas and bowling alleys must stay closed. Karen Chamas, London.
Ethiopia's prime minister says the army has been ordered to move on the embattled Tigray capital after his 72-hour ultimatum for Tigray leaders to surrender ended. Abiy Ahmed warns the city's 500,000 residents to stay indoors and disarm. The United Nations says an increasing number of people continue to leave Mekele even after the deadline expired. They join tens of thousands of newly displaced people throughout the region that remains almost completely sealed off from the world, beyond the reach of desperately needed food and other aid. Alarm over the safety of civilians is growing, and the prime minister has rejected international interference. Rome's airport will run COVID-tested flights to and from the United States, operated by Delta and Alitalia, adding it will be the first airport in Europe to offer the service on transatlantic flights. The hope is to avoid a mandatory 14-day quarantine that Italy imposes on incoming travelers. You can find more on our website, voanews.com. Reporting by remote, I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, November 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. There has been a second mining accident in Zimbabwe in the last 10 days.
We are having so many accidents because artisanal miners are not trained to work deep underground, and they are risk takers who just believe that they will make it anyhow.
Tanzania teams up with Mozambique to contain terrorists. South Sudan SPLM-IO says it repelled an attack by the South Sudan People's Defense Forces early Thursday morning. And the civil society group makes a court petition over alleged lack of transparency at the Ghana Electoral Commission.
It is very important for every individual who is eligible to participate in any public elections in this country do so without hindrance.
And Africa's top health official lays out a plan to deal with a second wave of coronavirus. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. There's been a second mining accident in Zimbabwe within the last 10 days. The latest happened early Thursday at Rand Gold Mine in the town of Bindura, about 70 kilometers north of the capital, Harare. About 40 miners were said to be trapped after a shaft inside the mine collapsed. Farai Manguwu, director of the Center for Natural Resource Governance in Zimbabwe, said one reason for the frequent accidents is the rise in informal mining syndicates, organized mostly by the country's ruling elites.
James, we have had two mining accidents in the past 10 days in Zimbabwe. The first one took place at Premier outside Mutare, where about 12 artisanal miners were buried underground by a Chinese company, which was subcontracted by some guys from Belarus. Only two bodies were recovered. And then today we have had another mine collapse in Bindura, where the number is still unclear, but it's believed between 17 and 40 people were trapped underground. And of those, 6 have been rescued alive, but badly injured. It's still difficult to ascertain how many people were underground, mainly because this is very informal trade. So the rescue operation is still ongoing, but mainly by artisanal miners themselves.
Now, mining is very important to the economy of Zimbabwe. Was this a government-approved mining operation, or this was just individuals trying to make a living?
Regarding the Bindura case, it sounds like these were artisanal miners who were just working as an informal syndicate. But then when you get deeper, closer to the situation, you realize that these groups are organized by politicians. They work under certain political authorities, and they also are the beneficiaries of the gold that is extracted by these artisanal miners. But they are not visible. You only get to know who they are when you start talking to the artisanal miners themselves.
What can you tell us about regulations in Zimbabwe?
We have got very good environmental laws, mining laws, but now we have a crisis whereby there is a lot of informalization of mining. Big corporations have been withdrawing from Zimbabwe, leaving behind some well-developed mines with no one taking care of the production underground. This is creating room for informal mining syndicates organized by the country's ruling elites to go in those mines. They are not trained properly in terms of how to work underground. They simply go for gold. And as a result, some pillars underground, which were left in order to ensure that there is safety underground, they are also being mined, which is creating hazards for the artisanal miners. That's why we are having so many frequent accidents. It's because artisanal miners are not trained to work deep underground, and they are risk takers who just believe that they will make it anyhow. And as a result, they are jeopardizing their lives as they go deeper underground. Sometimes they bring down the pillars which must be protecting them. And the Environmental Regulation Authority, it's also now very weak, mainly because politicians are in charge of the informal mining sector. The police, who must also be ensuring that they keep these people away, they are now complicit. They also extort money and gold from the artisanal miners. So the police, the law enforcement agents, are now part of the lawlessness. So the law is there, but no one is implementing because everybody is going for gold. It's the only area where you can get United States dollars.
Farai Manguwu is director of the Center for Natural Resource Governance in Zimbabwe. He was speaking with us from Harare. Tanzania's government says it is teaming up with Mozambique to launch a joint operation against violent attacks by Islamist militants along the Shear border. But some opposition parties and rights groups are raising concerns about how the Tanzanian government plans to tackle the threat. Charles Kumbe reports from Dar es Salaam.
Several recent attacks blamed on Islamist extremists have targeted the border village of Kitaya in Tanzania's Mtwara region. Police say more than 175 houses were set on fire and some people were killed by assailants, who, authorities say, fled into neighboring Mozambique. Tanzania has already increased the security along the border and it is now joining forces with Mozambique to contain what it calls terrorists. Simon Siro is Tanzania's police commander. He says there will be a joint operation because the attackers came from Mozambique and they have much information to make sure that we catch those terrorists. Siro adds that the big thing that we ask Tanzanians, especially for, is those who live in the neighboring villages to make sure they give us information. He also says there are many things that they have agreed that he can't say, but all is to help to catch those criminals. But Tanzanian opposition politicians worry about how the government will go about handling the threat. Boniface Jacob is a former Dar es Salaam mayor and a member of the opposition Chadema party. He says maybe the governments have taken and are still taking measures to fight terrorists, but he's dissatisfied with the level of sharing of information because it's everything. He says that, contrary to other countries, Tanzania has been secretive regarding terrorism, something that limits public information on the matter. Video has circulated recently on social media showing Kitaya villagers being killed by the alleged terrorists, who the government believes are aligned with the militant group Islamic State. Human rights groups say the government should be honest in providing information related to the attacks. Kumbusho Dawson is a rights activist. He says Tanzania police have been quiet. Information came out on social media, but police remained quiet. The United States Embassy issued a travel warning advising Americans about the threat in the south. Later, police spoke out. He asked that he thinks police should provide more information to the public about the terrorist acts taking place. Some citizens say it's scary hearing about the attacks, but they have hope that a government effort that works with local residents will deter terrorism. Saidi Musa is a Dar es Salaam resident. He says the video that was circulating on social media was not taken by the government. It's the citizen who took and shared them. He asked that they are the ones that have the primary information. Therefore, the government has to make sure that they work together with the citizens. Authorities say the attacks started in October when insurgents beheaded more than 20 residents of Kitaya. The government insists that it will succeed in its mission because it understands the motives of the insurgents. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
South Sudan's main rebel faction, SPLM-IO, says it repelled an attack early Thursday morning by the South Sudan People's Defense Forces, the SSPDF, on the Adijo and Moroto Unified Training Center in central Equatorial State. The SPLM-IO says one of its soldiers was killed and three others sustained minor injuries. SPLM-IO military spokesperson General William Gadjiev says the attack is yet another violation of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, which has yet to be fully implemented. South Sudan's military spokesperson was not immediately available for comment. Presidential spokesperson Atain Wekatain says he was unable to get reaction from the military. General Gadjiev says the SPLM-IO is certain it was the SSPDF that carried out the attack because they left behind identifiable uniforms.
This morning at around 6 a.m. East African time, Adijo and Moroto, the Unified Training Center, became under heavy attacks by the SSPDF forces. The fighting was on and said to have to be heavy when it was reporting. The SPLM-IO forces responded more professionally and excessively stormed the Rouk regime forces. Rafalsit scattered in disarray around the bushes of Maroto. Unfortunately, one comrade lost lives, plus three others sustained minor injuries from the SPLM-IO forces. Whereas on the side of the SSPDF, left behind their backs, a squad of soldiers exposed to direct sunlight and were all identified with their uniform. Moreover, the SPLM-IO leadership has learned and describes the Farinelles attacks from the regime as a serious violation, which is impeding the process and which finally marks the collapse of the already fragile peace agreement.
I want to know, General, why would the South Sudan army want to attack a station?
The SSPDF forces, they have been given orders by their military command leaderships because they don't want SPLM-IO forces around Juba. They want to chase them around Juba. This is simply, they are not ready for peace.
It seems that both the opposition SPLM-IO and the government, President Salva Kiir, there's not much being done to implement the peace process.
No, so it's not like that. The old SPLM-IO forces under Dr. Riek Machar have been in their defensive positions. So we don't even attack the government because we do really respect the peace agreement. But the SPDF under the regimes are the ones attacking our forces. It means that not all sides are ready to fight each other, but the government itself is fighting our forces.
The concern is that this bickering between the two sides is not helping the people of South Sudan.
Yes, we know that it has been so long for the grantees to bring the two sides to peace agreements. So it leads two sides to come together and sign this peace agreement. That was the reason why Dr. Machar signed the peace agreement in 2018 and went to Juba to implement the peace agreement. So up to now, this time alone, the all SPLM-IO forces didn't carry on an attack against the regimes.
General William Gadjiev is the military spokesperson for South Sudan's SPLM-IO rebel faction. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, November 27th. Care for Free and Fair Elections Ghana, a civil society group, has petitioned a human rights court over what the group says is the lack of transparency at the Ghana Electoral Commission. The group argues that the electoral body has been unable to publish the names of 32,621 prospective voters it removed from the voter list for the upcoming December elections. The Electoral Commission says the names were removed due to double registrations of the persons affected by the purge. But David Kumi Ado, Executive Secretary of Care for Free and Fair Elections Ghana, says the affected voters should be made aware of their status. He tells VOA's Peter Clotty that to ensure fairness and transparency in the process, the Human Rights Court should compel the Electoral Commission to publish the names and other details of the affected voters.
Prior to going to court, on the 17th of October, we wrote a letter to the Electoral Commission. The question that the Electoral Commission furnish us or publish the 32,621 names expunged from the register. We believe that it is very important for every individual who is eligible to participate in any public elections in this country do so without hindrance. Therefore, if the Electoral Commission says that these individuals have engaged in registration malpractice, therefore their names have been excluded from the register, we believe that the people, they are, as part of their human rights, will have to know. So we called on the Electoral Commission to publish the names. After a month, we didn't hear or not heard anything from the Electoral Commission.
Why do you need them to submit or publish the list? Why do you need them to do so?
I don't even know whether my name is in the actual register or my name is part of the 32,621. And over 13 million Ghanaians are sitting on tenterhooks. If you could remember, in the exhibition exercise, in Ashiama constituency, 21,000 names were not found in the register. Somewhere in Binduri, Upper East region, 867 registrants on the register were missing totally. So as we speak today, a lot of people are sitting on tenterhooks, and we don't even know whether our names are in the register or our names are not in the register. The Electoral Commission has not been straightforward with people. The Electoral Commission has a self-titled agenda, and it is implementing it without recourse.
The Electoral Commission recently, there were people who got the publication or soft copy of the voter list, and people were even questioning why the Electoral Commission published those names and make it readily available to Ghanaians. Others who support the Electoral Commission are saying this shows the transparency with which the Electoral Commission is attaching to this upcoming election. So why do you say the Electoral Commission is being opaque?
You see, the Electoral Commission is not being transparent. The transparency the Electoral Commission claims it is fake, it is pseudo transparency. The Electoral Commission is telling us what he wants us to hear. You see, going into this election, if there is going to be peace, it's going to be the way the Electoral Commission is going to this elections. The Electoral Commission today has dampened its image, and the credibility has been so much waned. As I speak to you, we've heard that the Electoral Commission says they were going to publish the names today. They said it yesterday. But even today, the Electoral Commission has not published the names. If the Electoral Commission published this name, it doesn't harm or it doesn't hurt. In fact, it will enhance the integrity of the Electoral Commission, enhance the credibility of the election that we are going into.
David Kumi Ado is Executive Secretary of Care for Free and Fair Elections Ghana. You're speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. Africa is bracing for a second wave of coronavirus, according to the continent's top medical official. Meanwhile, experts and governments say they are buoyed by news of three successful vaccine trials, and they hope to distribute the vaccine across the continent. VOA's Anita Powell has this report from Johannesburg.
As a second wave of coronavirus approaches, Africa has a plan, says the continent's top health official. In recent weeks, the continent has started to distribute 2.7 million rapid antigen tests. By mid-2021, health officials hope to vaccinate 60% of the continent's population with one of the several promising new vaccines. Now, says Dr. John Nkengasong, director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, it's up to the continent's leaders to try to make that happen.
And that will also require that we mobilize up to about $10 to $12 billion, including the cost of buying the vaccines and the cost of delivering the vaccines there. So that is the 60% mark that we really want to achieve. And I just really want everyone on this platform and our partners to understand that as a continent, that is our aspiration and our goal.
Dr. Nkengasong added that experts are working to bring more clinical trials to the continent. But he stressed, as COVID-19 numbers rise in some countries, notably South Africa, Kenya, and Algeria, the continent's health facilities appear to be weathering the onslaught.
We are not seeing hospitals being overwhelmed with COVID patients. That is clearly what our situation is. We are very encouraged that during the first wave, we didn't see that kind of overwhelming, which we were very, very worried and concerned with. That doesn't tell us that the second wave, that scenario will not happen. It only tells us that we have to prepare for and prepare using the three T's, which is the tests, the treat, the trace, and the treat.
As the continent approaches end-of-year holidays, he underscored one piece of advice.
Do not relent in wearing masks. One message that is emerging across the visits we are conducting across the continent is people are not masking enough. And in some settings, absolutely, it seems like they are not masking at all. And that is extremely dangerous. My worry and fear is that the sacrifices and gains that were made since the beginning of this year those gains that were made in terms of bringing the pandemic down to where we were in October may be completely wiped off if we relent at this point.
So there you have it, from the continent's top medical expert. Wear your mask, wash your hands, keep your distance, and stay safe. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with Friday's final of the Total CAF Champions League final between Zamalek FC and Al Ahly FC scheduled for the Cairo International Stadium. CAF and the Egyptian Football Association have both confirmed that the final will be played behind closed doors as part of safety measure to contain the spread of COVID-19. The 2020 CAF Champions League final will be the first final in the competition history to be played between teams from the same country. Zamalek and Al Ahly have met competitively 215 times, with the Red Devils of Al Ahly triumphant on 91 occasions, the White Knights of Zamalek 50 times, and there have been 74 matches drawn between both sides. Looking at other statistics ahead of Friday's crucial encounter, Al Ahly hold four Confederation of African Football Club competitions records with overall 19 wins, with 8 Champions League titles, 6 Super Cup titles and 4 African Cup Winners' Cup titles. However, they've not won a CAF competition since lifting the Confederation Cup trophy for the only time in 2014, their longest spell this century without African silverware. On their part, Zamalek have won the Champions League 5 times, the Super Cup 4 times, the African Cup Winners' Cup 1 time and Confederation's Cup 1 time for a total of 11 titles in total, making them the equal second most successful club in CAF competitions. I asked some sports fans what they make of Friday's final between the two Egyptian club rivals.
I go with Al Ahly triumphing at the end of the day, basically because of the Pitso Mosimane's factor that has been brought into the side.
I believe it's going to be a topsy-turvy affair, and it's a game that will go either side.
Head-to-head between the two clubs, Zamalek always comes out tops. I'm very, very sure that Zamalek would win.
And news just in says 3 stars, each from Egyptian clubs Al Ahly and Zamalek, have tested positive for coronavirus and will miss the CAF Champions League final in Cairo on Friday. This is according to Egyptian football officials. Meanwhile, the 2020-2021 Total CAF Champions League season kicks off this weekend with the first leg fixtures of the first preliminary round taking place across the continent. Away from CAF Champions League now, Junior Chipolopolo of Zambia will face host South Africa in the final of the COSAFA Under-17 Cup on Sunday at the Glavendale Stadium in Port Elizabeth. In athletics, women's marathon world record holder Bridget Kosgei of Kenya has announced that she was gearing up for the New Delhi's half marathon on Sunday, dismissing fears around the novel coronavirus outbreak and the polluted air in India's capital city. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, November 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butt in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.